This is Emergency FD Storyline.
We had serious gunshot wounds that day. How quickly they got him to the hospital, I believe lives were saved.
My understanding is that's the first time you've actually had EMS enter in with law enforcement while you still had an active shooter scene going.
If there's an ambulance here and there's a patient here that has a serious gunshot wound, a penetrating trauma above the torso, we're going to put them on that ambulance and get them off the X.
Look around and get the big picture, and you look around and you see all these ambulances here. You think, this isn't supposed to happen here.
Any first responder who's been up against that wall, they need to talk to somebody that knows what they've been through.
If you meet the objectives, and the objective was saving lives, and you do everything you can to make that happen, that shows you care and that you have trained and worked to put yourself in a position to save those lives, and that's what they did.
An active shooter situation. What do you do? The objective is to save lives, and obviously it takes law enforcement. But treating mass casualties requires fire departments and emergency medical services to be on the scene. An immediate, coordinated response saves lives when you are on the firing line. The views expressed on this program are from the guests and the host and do not necessarily represent the views of any government agency, private company, or public service. Emergency FD Storyline's focus is to tell the stories of those in the fire service and to highlight what matters to our first responders. It can happen anywhere, and it did. On September 21st, 2021, the place was Collierville, Tennessee, often known for being one of the many suburbs surrounding Memphis, Tennessee. This incident became the first known case where police and fire entered together while an active shooter incident was in progress. Active shooter, the fire line. That's our storyline. An active shooter scene. I know it well. And so does one of our five guests on this podcast, retired firefighter George Langston. George will join us with some closing thoughts at the end of this podcast, and so will Collierville Fire Chief John Selberg, so stay with us. Active shooter on the fire line. This is the story of the Collierville Fire Department. It's the story of the Germantown Fire Department and all the other agencies that provided mutual aid on the tragic scene that day and in the days that followed the event. Before we talk to three individuals who played key roles on the scene, I want to play portions of the original radio traffic as the incident unfolded. You will hear the voice of one of our guests, Incident Commander and Collierville Fire Department Battalion Chief Mike Sansone, as he works the incident.
Dispatch, Battalion 31.
Battalion 31, go ahead.
Have you been advised of something going on at Kroger?
Check, we got an active shooter.
Check. Dispatch from Battalion 31, start all companies and have them stage Poplar and Bahia area.
Check, Battalion 31.
Also, all unit, request mutual aid from Germantown and advise 102 of the situation.
Check.
All companies from Battalion 31, go ahead and put your armor on.
I have a report of one off, one down near the deli with a gunshot wound to possible shoulder, and also another party down outside Kroger near ATC side, gunshot wound to the shoulder and to the back.
Dispatch, Battalion 31. How many all together do you have right now?
We don't have an exact count. We have multiple callers calling in at this time. As of right now, I've taken four for the officer. I took one call as one, so at least at this time, four.
Let me know when we're secure enough to start moving that way, or I can get some police with me to start moving that way. Also, contact every agency for mutual aid on ambulances and ACLS units if they can send me.
Battalion 31, I'm trying to get on the radio. We've got CPD advising at the rear of Kroger. The rear of Kroger is secure and multiple subjects down at the rear of Kroger.
Check. Can you also check with other agencies and get me mutual aid? I'll get an engine company over there. 81 and 82, since it's secure, can you go that direction with your body armor on?
Battalion 31, 83, we're almost to the rear this time. If you want to spin, pull into that location.
Check. Can I get two units back there, please?
Engine 82 is responding. Dispatch, we have parties at Station 2 in the bay hiding. They're uninjured, but they were non-involved.
Dispatch from Battalion 31, do you have an area secure?
Negative, Battalion 31, not at this time. time.
Okay, just keep me updated when you got it secure. Is it secure? At the dumpsters behind ATC.
Okay, check. We're trying to figure it out. We may have one of them detained. We're standby. We're trying to confirm that.
Check. Dispatch, Battalion 31. I know I'm bothering you. Let me know about some mutual aid units. I need more ambulances and more ACLS companies.
Check. I've got Shelby County. They're sending an engine company as well as an ambulance. Germantown was notified, and they're going to send as many as they can. I'll contact Memphis.
Call with dispatch, Germantown Battalion 41, responding to Newberry Road.
Okay, Germantown from Battalion 31. If I can have your resources go to the front doors of Kroger, I've had the scene secure, and I have many parties down. I also need as many units as you can send me.
En route now, I'm going to try to staff some more and see what else I can get.
Check, Chief. I need all you got right now. All you got.
Check. Right now, I've got two ambulances. What else do you need?
I need all the units you can. I have many parties down.
Okay, check.
You know, there are incredible stories in the fire service, and some of those are just ones that you can't imagine that could happen that you can find yourself in. And this story that we're talking about today happened in Collierville, Tennessee, of all places, a place that I've known well for years growing up outside of Memphis, Tennessee. It was an active shooter at a Kroger store in the area. And with me is Lieutenant Jimbo Hunsucker, Battalion Chief Mike Sansone, and Germantown Chief Eric Grizzard. Tell me a little bit about each of your roles, who you are, and what you were doing that particular day. Let me talk with you.
Jimbo Hunsucker, and I'm a lieutenant paramedic. So that day for me, I was off duty, was actually on vacation, but happened to be near the Kroger when the incident happened, received a phone call.
And Chief Grizzard, how about you?
Eric Grizzard, Chief of Germantown Fire Department. At the time, I was the Operations Chief for Germantown Fire Department.
Mike Sansone, Battalion Chief, paramedic on the C shift, Collierville Fire Department.
This incident happened about what time?
1:30. I know I'd just gotten my lunch. And I had it in my car with me.
You wound up being incident commander.
I did.
Tell us a little bit about what happened.
That day I was out just a normal day riding when you're a battalion chief. I was out checking on my stations and making what we call rounds that day. And I'd stop by to get me something out to eat. I was in our very west, southwest area of our station. I just pulled into the parking lot and was going to walk in there. I usually was going to grab lunch there. And I received a phone call from my Station 2, Engine 82's house, that they had some civilians running into their station bay area and into the station and were saying that they had an active shooter at Kroger and there was a lot of people down, a lot of people hurt.
And so when you heard that, again, you hadn't really heard anything over the air about it.
That's correct. At that time, you know, I said, you know, what's going on? He told me. So I made a radio call to our dispatcher, and that's where they advised me we had an active shooter, Kroger.
Dispatch, Battalion 31.
Battalion 31, go ahead.
Have you been advised of something going on at Kroger?
Check, we got an active shooter.
And then, Jimbo, how did you get involved with this?
So I would assume shortly after that, when the guys were responding, the driver at the time for me at Station 5 was actually riding in my spot while I was on vacation, and he made several attempts to call me. I wasn't in a position to answer the phone, and then I started receiving several text messages that he needed me to call him. And then that was quickly followed by a video of them as they're going down the street, lights and sirens. And I can hear Chief Sansone in the background on the radio asking, how many patients are there?
Dispatch, Battalion 31. How many all together do you have right now?
We don't have an exact count. We have multiple callers calling in at this time.
So I made a phone call back, talked with Jim. And he told me that there was an active shooter at Kroger. And then he also told me that they were going to be staging at the Memphis Pizza Cafe, which happened to be where I was. So I told him I would meet him outside. And that's where I met them.
You were coming back from vacation.
Right.
So you didn't look clean cut that day, did you?
Correct. I didn't look the part of a fireman. So as I'm talking with Jim, he's asking me to get on the truck. I said, man, I can't get on the truck. You know, I'm thinking, first of all, I've got this beard going, been on a couple of week vacation. There's nothing for me to do there. I don't have any ballistic gear, which fortunately we had at the time. So when I got there, after these guys are dressed and we're going down the street, get to Chief Sansone and ask him what he needs. He gave me the assignment and asked me to help get ambulances in and out, help him with triage and transport. Knowing that I've got this beard and I'm fixing to tell these ambulances where to go, instead of just being some bearded guy in a parking lot trying to direct ambulances, I decided to grab one of the guys' turnout jacket and radio so that I'm somewhat representative of a fire department. So that's what I did.
Chief Grizzard, again, Germantown Fire Department. You're not in Collierville where this took place, but Germantown borders Collierville, shall we say sister communities for sure when it comes to the Memphis area. How did you get involved with? What happened that got you to that scene, and when did you get there?
I was actually in a staff meeting. My on-duty battalion chief called me two or three times in a row because I was in a staff meeting. I'd send him to voicemail, and I realized about the third time there was something wrong. When I picked up the phone, he said, "You need to get out to Collierville Kroger. They're shooting up the Kroger." That was the extent of the conversation. I don't even think I said anything to the rest of the staff. I just got up and left, started responding. When I turned the radio on, I heard our companies. I knew we had an engine and a couple of ambulances responding, and our on-duty battalion chief as well. And interestingly enough, en route, I got a phone call from a friend of mine that's a staff officer from Memphis Fire Department that said, "What do you need? How many do you need?" And I said, "You know, I don't know. What do you know? And she told me, "Well, I've been told it's a running gunfight, and there's between 20 and 30 victims." Until I got here, that was pretty much all the information that I had.
Chief Senso, you can tell me a little about this. What did you know other than that call? Did you see anything? What was it when you got there that happened? Because were you the first to get there?
No, I think we all kind of collided at the same time. The first thing we did was we made sure we had body armor. We had ballistic gear. And so we wanted to make sure that all of our companies had that on. All the people that were coming in.
All companies from Battalion 31, go ahead and put your armor on.
Part of the story is, before this particular incident, you guys had just gone through some training with this, or you had been working on this. Tell me about that.
First of all, I think the most important part is that our town officials decided to invest in this gear. So we had not had it very long. But my shift, I had just gotten promoted, and on the B shift had done a scenario where we had went in at our high school and practiced a shooting where we went in with the police at the same time, and we treated patients with them. Well, they basically had our back, watched us as we made our way through the building. Now, the C shift had not had that training. So I was kind of directing something that they hadn't a lot of knowledge on, but they implemented it.
And so that was something that was new. So when you got there, you had this ballistic gear. What, a year before that you wouldn't have had?
That's correct.
We're going to get to that, how important that was, I guess, going in on a situation like this. And again, training with law enforcement, because you said something, you knew they had your back.
That's right. We had practiced this, and we knew that if they were watching us, we could do our job. And as large scale as this thing laid out on a piece of property as large as it was, it would have took forever to clear it. We knew we needed to get in there and start rendering that care as quickly as possible.
And Jimbo, did you go inside, or where were you involved with this?
So I stayed on the outside the whole time. My job, after talking with Chief Sanson, was to get the ambulances lined up for transporting these patients that the guys were bringing out. So that's where I kind of stayed, ran into some radio issues, weren't able to communicate with the ambulances that were coming, and sure didn't know which ones were coming. So I kind of ran around the parking lot and tried to organize the ambulances best I could. So I stayed on the outside.
And when you got there, Chief Rizard, what did you see?
Chaos. a lot of people coming in, but a lot of people going out also. So when I first pulled in, before I got out of my vehicle, I called MedCom and just said, "Hey, I don't know if anybody's told you yet, but I've got an active shooter situation at Kroger in Collierville. And we think we have a lot of people down, and you're probably going to start hearing a bunch of requests for transports." And so when I got out, I made contact initially with Chief Sanson and asked him who had command, and we talked about that. And then the next question was, "Okay, what do you need?" And the decision was made. You know, we had a brief conversation about we were having a lot of difficulty with radio traffic, about talking to people and understanding exactly what resources were on the scene. I don't think either one of us at the time had an idea of the scope of what we were looking at. And he said, probably the first thing I'm going to need is help with setting up treatment, triage, and transport to get these people out of here.
One thing I just want to bring out, I guess, all three of you are paramedics.
Yes, sir.
And that's kind of unique. Did that, as far as this coordinating this, did that help you guys get that in your head, what needed to be done?
I think we knew the speed, just for what we do every day. You know, you know you want to treat, you know you want to transport, you know you want to organize the best you can out of chaos, like he said. You know those are your goals. And we've all had training in most of the fire departments on this kind of situation. However, we learned that some of it works and some of it does not, or you can tweak it, or each incident's a little different. I think we were all had the same goal when we were discussing things. When we were coming in, I would say that all three of us and all the agencies had the same goal. Get in there and get out. But easier said than done. A parking lot full of squad cars, civilians, there was a lot of challenges there. that I think we overcame really quickly and easily and got it worked out.
I think it helped that we were all paramedics, but I also think that it helped that both of the agencies focused their training at every level of that, whether you are a paramedic or not. There's been a lot of incident command type training, a lot of communications training, and a lot of medical training. And so, yeah, I think paramedic helped, but I think the investment throughout each level of the organization also helped a lot.
You know what else really helped was that we really work a lot together on a everyday, you know, scenario. You know, we run mutual aid with each other. We work house fires together. We share resources at times, communicate well together. You don't want to work that out at that time on that kind of incident. You won't already have that kind of relationship before some large incident like this comes in. And I think that we had that, especially with Germantown, the county. I think that helped a lot. Y'all think so?
Absolutely. I think in the situation that we were in at the time, having contract ambulance service and two ambulances serving a town of 50,000 people, we sought help from Germantown and Shelby County a lot. And that really built our relationship with those agencies. Knowing each other personally, we know a lot of those guys and girls that came over from Germantown and the county. So most definitely that helped. And like Chief Grizzard and Chief Sanson both have said, the training, whether or not it was even active shooter training, just any kind of mass casualty training prepared you for this day. It just happened to be this day was an active shooter situation. But even if you think back many years to the white powder calls, and we were talking about how to get mass people out and decon them, you know, your training, it come out that day.
When I heard what happened, I thought, you know, this is usually supposed to happen in Memphis. You guys are what's referred to as the suburbs outside of Memphis. And this stuff happens in Memphis, but it doesn't happen in Germantown or Collierville. And that is kind of the thing I think goes through a lot of the mindset of a lot of citizens and people. In your wildest dreams, you never thought you would find yourself in a situation quite like this. You're having to take control of that scene. What was that like, I guess, realizing what was happening and what you didn't know for a long time? When it was going to be resolved, or if it was resolved. So right now you had somebody that could be shooting at you. And so what was the mindset going through? Each of you comment on that.
My mindset was to, you know, how am I going to organize this thing? You know, so much information that was widespread. We had these patients here. We had the patients here. We didn't know how many patients we had here. I kind of fell back on the training that I'd had, just the incident command system. You know, working a fire or working any major incident, you know, this thing's going to have to be worked like a large incident. And we're going to have to get kind of some divisions going here and get some staging, get some transportation in place, somebody to document some stuff. My mindset was, how am I going to do that? Because every hand I had was working, was literally on somebody working. I kind of calmed down and got me a good 360, and I rode the complex. And when I first got there, I rode the whole thing from the rear. And I noticed that in the rear, we had a lot going on. Had a lot of patients there. And then they had called for a command post somewhere, and it really didn't work out. So I quickly realized that I wanted to go to the front door, that I needed to know what was going on. Our radios weren't communicating as well as we'd like to. And I knew there was going to be a lot of face-to-face there. And that's where it kind of all started at. The way I kind of pictured in my mind was like a large fire. I'll have a Charlie division, and I'll have an Alpha one here, and we'll work it that way. I just kind of went back to what I'd always learned when I was a small kid in the fire department, just start working the thing up and try to organize it.
Jimbo, what about you? You're coming back from vacation, so this is like, all right, you're back.
I fully didn't expect to end up in the parking lot of Kroger this afternoon.
Yeah.
You know, and talking about my mindset while I'm there, obviously I was not thinking that this would be a national news headline. You know, like you mentioned, you don't think this would happen in your community, but I will say we were prepared. Fortunately, we were prepared. We had administration and town officials that saw an incident like this potentially happening here. So we had the equipment, we had the training, but my mindset was not on those bigger things. It was, as each of these patients come out this door, I need to have them a mode of transportation. We've got to get them to the hospital. We can do what we can do here, but they need a surgeon potentially, especially knowing they've got penetrating trauma. So my mindset is keeping us safe, safely get these people out, have them a way to get to the hospital.
Chief Grizzard, how about you? You've arrived. You kind of took a little bit of command off of the hands of everybody that was in Collierville, I guess you could say, when it comes to help organizing. Well, tell me your role specifically again.
I don't know if I would go that far. I think I would say trying to identify what the problem is. Chief Sanson said something that I thought was not something that people should miss. I think once we try to figure out what was going on and wrap our head around this, then you can apply some structure to it. You know, treatment, triage, transport, staging, medical, command area, but not knowing in such a big box retail place, like how large is his event and which structure do you apply to it? Do you do divisions? Is everything going to be on the alpha side? Sometimes when we talk about this, and we've talked about it a lot over the last couple of years, I think that there's small things that I remember each time. I always worry when we're telling this story, people forget how important that is. You know, the solution was there. And how do you apply that solution? Once you identify how big the problem is, okay, well, now we can start putting these different thought processes to it. Where are we going to set up our casualty collection point? And, you know, we had a really brief conversation about which type of triage we were going to use that I think had a dramatic outcome on this event. Once we realized the scope of it, though, we were able to apply all of those roles. We weren't going to be able to talk to on the radios. There was too many different agencies. There was some duplication of resources that everybody did the right thing, but they were unable to talk to the other groups. And so we were duplicating those different things. Kind of what my role, once we set up the medical and we made the decision about the triage and transport, was to help facilitate those conversations between all the different areas of operation on that scene. That's kind of where I filled in.
What happened after that, and everyone begins to show up? Did you know that this particular perpetrator was down? Tell me the cloud of that. What was that like?
We did not. Actually, during this incident, several times we got told there was another shooter, or, hey, we've got a shooter. I think at least twice more as the incident went on. We never really knew, but we knew if they could secure a little area that we were going to get in there. We weren't going to wait for the whole thing to be over with before we went in.
So how did that happen?
Well,
how did you get in there?
So while en route, I kept asking over and over again, let me know when you have an area secure. Let me know when you can get police officers with us so we can go in. I knew that within that training, that if we had some police officers that could escort us to where people were hurt at, then we could start doing our job and what we needed to do. Especially with the gear we had, I felt like that was a good decision. And we had bought it and we knew we were going to use it, you know, if this incident came up. So immediately on the rear, the Charlie side, if you think about that, we got told that we had police officers on the scene. And so we put some resources back there. That was a dumpster area where the shooter had kind of corralled some people in. And so we had some injuries back there, some pretty good shooting. And that's where we thought the worst was. And then we started gathering with the police officers and started going through the building. And we found out we really had our more serious victims inside. And so what we did there, we had kind of the incident up in the alpha side. And what we decided was that's where we started organizing our units. So we had some units that went to the rear and started transporting right off the bat. And then we started bringing some patients out and treating them. We triaged critical and non-critical. And we had enough resources there pretty quickly that we could start loading. I told Jimbo when he walked up, I said, I want units coming in this a lane and I want them coming out another lane. Let's get it cleared out to do that. Because we're all
another thing that we discussed was critical and non-critical. That was something else you had said to me.
And that's how I kind of did. And so I had people working, and then we had some that were non-critical that went to critical. And we bumped them over and got them out of there pretty quickly. But it was getting those steps in place where we could get people in and out. Getting in there with the police officers, if you notice from some of the pictures, they're just standing there with their backs turned to us, watching as we treat and removed.
There was a group that went in the alpha sector in the front and went all the way to the back, correct?
There were several groups that went in with police officers and worked those areas and started treating people and working on people, getting them out.
And it was quick. And this was all happening within, what, a 10 minutes, 5, 10?
I believe we had, from the time we got on the scene, I believe we had hands-on our patients within 10 minutes. And I think we had them outside and we're starting to load them within that period of time also. Would you agree?
I would say so from looking at the times. That's the case.
Who saw the injuries, or who noticed the injuries first, or what was it that you knew about?
My companies that went in, my engine and ladder companies that went in, squad companies that went in, when they got to a patient and started treating, they were advising myself, Chief Grizzard, Jimbo, what they had. And so what we started doing was prioritizing in a non-critical and a critical manner. And then as our units got there and started moving up, we put them in there and we were shooing them off. Don't stick here. You got to go somewhere. And so we didn't clog up our area. And that's how we went that way.
You were mentioning to me, Chief Grizzard, we were talking earlier that the way to treat something like this is, okay, do you let them hang around or what do you do? Are we going to sit here and spent a lot of time in triage. What were we going to do? And tell me that overall scene there that we were listening to, we're looking at.
Sure. So a couple of my medics that worked for Germantown were letting me know, hey, we've got a couple of criticals. One of the things that I noticed, there was a lot of resources arriving really quickly, and they were kind of flooding the parking lot. So I had a moment where I was pretty aware that we were, from based off of what we were being told, we were going to have enough ambulances on scene. We had a conversation on the hood of the battalion vehicle. It was a really quick conversation. When I said, hey, you know, what's going on? What do you need? He said, well, let's talk about triage and setting medical up. And we looked around, and I knew how many ambulances were coming. And I said, hey, let's just get them out of here. You know, there's no sense in delaying any treatment. And there was still some victims that were self-assisting themselves out. I can see them clear as day that were coming out. One gentleman had a gunshot, you know, through the abdomen, came out his back. It was pretty clear they were all bad. And so we decided we're not going to delay and take the time. We start triage and tag them and clog up the parking lot. If there's an ambulance here and there's a patient here that has a serious gunshot wound, a penetrating trauma above the torso, we're going to put them on that ambulance and get them off the X, tell them to go. I'm pretty passionate about that decision, that I think it saved some people's lives there without that delay. Because ultimately, as one of these gentlemen mentioned earlier, the treatment for a gunshot wound is surgery. We didn't have that capability. It also helped free up the transportation corridor, because you didn't have a lot of ambulances just clogging up space and not able to put the next patient on the ambulance.
Pretty much the same thing all three of you were seeing at the same time.
And it was a little different than what we'd do for the normal gunshot or trauma call. We would usually sit there and kind of assess, and that you weren't under that pressure. But I think that we all decided pretty quickly that we had to get them out. And they were going to have to work as independent units. And if they wanted to pull around the corner and start working, which I don't think they did, they needed a working route. They needed to get to the trauma center. They needed to do their own call into MedCom and let those resources decide on where you'd go. Not all of them went to our trauma center. We had some go to Baptist Memphis, some to Methodist, and let that system work, because we couldn't worry about that. I think we decided pretty quickly we all had the mindset of speed.
I know the first two that got there, that's exactly what I told them. You need to get your patient, and I need you to go. You've got to clear this area. You can take someone with you. We would often send a rider, one of our paramedics with Rural Metro Ambulance that was for us. So I told that crew, I need you to get your patient. You can take somebody with you, but you've got to go after that. You've got to get out of the way. And then I think Chief Grizzard and them were on the way. And once he got here, that's when it became more organized, and there was a path for ambulances. But initially, both of those crews were told, please get your patients and get out of here. You got to go.
You think about it, this is almost like the fog of war. Because, you know, you were coming in and you just heard maybe could be as many as 20 people hanging out there, or
right,
could be 20 victims.
Running gun battle.
Yeah. Where is this guy? Is he down? Is he not? So that's what you're dealing with. Is that something that's very hard to describe? You can't put that in the planner, can you? Although the training, you keep talking about the training.
The training helps, and having a plan or having it told. I knew that we had to call for a lot, because we never knew how – I don't think I ever knew how many patients we had until it was really over with and we started counting, because they were all at one time. We really got our hands on them really quickly, and then they were all outside right here under us on that side, and in the rear they had them all together. You know, I really don't even know if I knew that number. I knew to call for a lot of help, better to turn them around if we don't need them. I didn't know what we were going to find in other places. Who had maybe gotten shot, ran into other buildings, went around the corner, was still hiding somewhere that we didn't know. You know you're in a live area, and this is going on. But at the same time, I felt very calm and secure that we were safe. You know, you're worried about your personnel, just like you are on any incident. And, you know, there's always a threat on anything that we do of getting hurt or something. It felt secure there. It felt like the police had everything. They were going in with us. We were able to get our work done. People were coming out that were hurt. We were getting them out and we were treating them. I think there was kind of a secure feeling that this is okay. It did come up several times that there was another shooter. It ended up being false, but the police were really good at taking us to where we needed to go to secure an area, or watching us while we treated somebody. While we were out front, they had us a good perimeter set up right there while we were doing our job.
Still a little bit chaotic in all of that. You had the incident with a woman walking up, or did all of you see that, or was that mainly came up to you? Or what
we all saw it, I think, simultaneously.
Tell me that incident.
She had been treated by an engine company because she had been bandaged, and I talked to that company later, and they said that was all she was wanting at the time while they saw her inside, and then she left and got on the phone. I guess it's like Chief Grizzard said, she went into maybe another building on that complex somewhere, and then after making her phone calls, I guess she decided that she needed to go to the hospital.
Hey, I guess it's time for me to go. She just walked up just as, I guess I'm ready to go to the hospital.
And what did you see? What was it?
In a similar situation, I had one of my guys walk up to me and say, Chief, there's two or three patients back here by the garbage cans. This was probably 20 or 30 minutes into it. I talked to the individual that had been assigned back there. He said, no, we transported them all. There's nobody back there. And so you kind of just blew it off. My guy came back to me. He said, Chief, there's two people back there requesting transport. They're non-critical, but they're injured. Okay. Those two people had been hiding somewhere in Kroger, I think, back by the freezers. They were having anxiety. I actually think, in retrospect, I think one had gone across the street into the Northern Tool Complex and then come back, and they were having some medical issues related to it. But I think when you tie those together, then the individual that came back injured also, there's no telling where people are going to go when something happens and how long it'll be before they kind of come back to your scene.
When you get to the end of the scene, and this is finally, if you could say, somewhat wrapped up, it's under control. When did you find out about the perpetrator? How did this thing end?
Kind of early on, that we did know that we had a fatality on the scene, and we felt like that was him. However, as the thing evolved more and more, the rumors started. There's another shooter. There's somebody here. They didn't get him. You know, there was a second one, a third time. I know there was two other times where we went, wait a minute, they're saying there's another one. And I think that's always going to happen, Tom, when you have something this large scale. There's just so much chaos going on. You know, at the end of it, did this just really happen? Did this really happen? I don't want to say you're in shock, but it's almost what just went on. Because when you're working, you're just busy. And then it's just like, is this what went on?
I've heard that before. I'm busy. I'm doing what a firefighter, what a paramedic does. I've heard that from other people before. Each of you tell me a little bit of that. After it was done, what was running through your head?
It's like Chief was saying, while you're working, you're busy and not thinking about this. But one of the first times that I can remember slowing down was when they said that they thought there was an explosive device in the shooter's car, which at the time we did not know was the shooter's car. So we were asked to back up while they cleared the area. So while we were standing way out in the parking lot, this thing kind of slows down. And I would say that majority of the patients, if not all, had been transported by then, fortunately. Maybe the incident with the lady in the shoulder was after this, but for the most part, the critical patients were gone. So you're starting to slow down and you're starting to look around and get the big picture. And you look around and you see all these ambulances here. You think, this isn't supposed to happen here. So it starts to hit you then. There's still a job to be done. So we had to finish up. But for me, something important that happened was, Chief, whether you did or not, whoever asked Germantown to kind of stick around in the city and cover some calls for us. It was important to me that we all gathered back at our station too and had that 30 minutes or an hour to debrief and talk with each other. That helps a lot.
I was worried about my personnel at that time. I'd gotten with my command staff and it said that we needed to get together. However, we had made a structure fire as soon as we got in service.
Oh, you did. That
right in service.
Show has to go on.
And we just immediately got on our rigs. It didn't end up wasn't much of anything. But everybody did collide on the scene, and we were working again, going to work. But after it was over with, I said, I want everybody to go back to headquarters. Or not headquarters, our station two, which is centrally located. And we just got together and talked. I call that a diffusing. That's where I looked and I got with a couple of my other people that I trust, and I said, let's make sure everybody's okay, that we're all acting normal. You know, I wanted to see the firemen joking, the cutting up, the playing start to happen again. I was looking for people not standing off, not really communicating, not really talking. And then there was just a lot of checking on your people. But we did get the counselors in here. I think we did a multi-agency one. I was actually off, and we did a full
debrief on everything.
Debriefing on everybody to make sure they were okay. I'm pretty passionate about that. I don't think we did it early on in my career the right way. We have done that a couple of times right, and I think we practiced that here.
Same with you, Chief Grizzard. How did that – I mean, you had personnel there that were dealing with that in the back.
I did the same thing. We got back to the station. I actually didn't have to reach out to them. They reached out to me. The men and women that responded to this call did an amazing job. I don't think you can do it better. I'd like to point that out. And so that's what I was able to tell them. It's like, you guys were awesome. You know, I think that you did a tremendous job in terrible circumstances. They seemed okay. One of them that lives in the area also had the same feeling that I still have to this day. And I'll be very transparent about it. Anger, you know, it just kind of still hacks me off when I think about it, that somebody could disrupt a bunch of people's lives like that.
And again, you mentioned you live where?
I live less than a block away. I'm in that Kroger every day. So is my family. My son was actually calling me while I was standing up front working the call. He's in that Kroger usually at that time every day anyway. So that was always on my mind. And Chief Shelberg's here. He'll kind of laugh about this. He's, you know, I think I was mad, like really mad for about a month after that. And I still carry around a little bit of that. That was pretty much the feeling that the crews that I dealt with had. They were a little frustrated, but they felt like they put their best foot forward and made a real difference in people's lives. Did a good job. There was two phone calls I made to people that I work with a lot. One was our medical director, and one was my predecessor in the operations chief job was Jeff Beeman. And I said, hey, I want you to shut up, and I'm going to talk, and I'm going to tell you everything that happened the way that I see it right now. Because I knew I was very emotional, and to be honest, still a little bit. Sometimes your memory becomes clouded when you hear other people's stories as well. There's so much emotion and so much going on. And I'm not saying anybody's wrong, but your perception changes. And so I just dumped on those two with all the relevant things that happened, you know, because they weren't there. And then that way, later on, when I would talk to them, they would say, well, you know, remember, this is what you told me. It was a hot wash of lessons learned. If anybody's ever made a traumatic call, sometimes your memories become intertwined with other people's memories. And is that exactly how it happened? And you don't really always know. But that was something that I would encourage anybody that did this. Find somebody that you're close to, that you work with, that wasn't there, and just start talking about it. You know, write it down maybe. Find somebody that you can give an unfiltered, this is what it was, because it's almost like a playback for you later.
Rest of you, same thing, anything as far as the feelings, the emotions of it that still stay with you?
You know, it's almost like any call that you deal with, you know, that's serious like that, or, you know, a bad car wreck, a good fire, it's chaos and it's real high. And then all of a sudden you start to fall. You know, with a call like that, it was, you know, check on your people, make sure you're okay. What's special that a lot of people deal with and don't deal with in the fire service is we have to ride by that place every day. That's my Kroger also. I live less than a block away. Grew up in that area. That's been my Kroger since I started school. So I've walked in that place, shop, from my whole life, and still do. And it does, when you walk through there, you go, wow, did this happen here? Was it? You park in the parking lot and look at it and think about how it looked that day compared to what it is today. It's real all the time. It's not somewhere where we go to work and we only go back there if we go to work. It's right here. My engine companies go through there every day and buy their groceries to eat.
What about you?
I think maybe like Chief Grizzard said, you find yourself being angry about it. And it's to the point that even if it's not that particular building, walking back in there and seeing that, or just being in that parking lot, knowing what all took place in that parking lot, I find myself more cautious. And it just makes you angry that you have to think about these things now, going in whatever store that you could find yourself in the middle of this, or, you know, angry for my kids who may have to deal with this at school one day. So I think it's unfortunately an environment that we live in. So it just kind of makes you angry that we have to say that's where we're at now.
You wouldn't think 28 years ago when I got into this line of work and we started that would be the kind of classes that'd be the stuff that we'd have to worry about. It was, how are you going to cut somebody out? How quick you can get a line on the ground? How fast you do this? And who would have thought that's going to be the largest incident that you made was a mass shooting incident? I don't think they were telling us that when we signed up years ago to get into fire service, that was kind of calls you would make.
I guess you look back at it now, you're kind of glad that you had that training.
Sure, but it's not what a firefighter is supposed to do. It's not what engine companies are supposed to show up and go to. And then you think, well, that won't happen here, and it could happen anywhere.
Tell me what you guys did right. The lessons, the good lessons that you want to share, because this was a good incident.
It's like Chief Grizzard told his people, and we told ours, y'all did this exactly the way it's supposed to be done. These guys never asked, never questioned, never held up. We're fighting really on the radio, if you listen to the audio, to get in quick and fast. And they went in and started treating people mutual aid. If you're in a leadership role of your fire department, make sure that those surrounding areas, you have all that worked out before something happens. Practice it, talk, have discussions. You know, hats off to Germantown, Shelby County, Memphis, the private Fayette County that responded, and we just clicked. We all worked together and were able to, you know, common goal and implement it. The men and women that worked that day, I don't feel like I've given them enough credit during this. They went in, and because of what they did and how they treated and how fast they got out and how quickly they got them to the hospital, I believe lives were saved. We had serious, serious gunshot wounds that day. And I think time and speed happened. Off duty. We're not a very large department. Jimbo, Joe Lee Rape coming in and taking those functions were huge, major. Lives were saved because of that. And I think that's the stuff we did right. And our community, our leaders, buying us the right gear so we could go in there safely. Those things work.
Two things. There were no egos, and nobody got so overwhelmed by the situation that they withdrew. A lot of times in moments of stress, from a command perspective, you'll see people kind of withdraw, and they'll wall themselves off, and they'll start barking out orders and not processing information. And none of that happened. Even with the challenges in the communications, the different working areas had multiple face-to-faces where they changed information, changed little things about what we were doing because it was no longer relevant. So the no egos and the, despite the radio challenges, the communications were spectacular with all things considering. So that's something that I think that can get overlooked, but that I think that went very well on that scene.
What was really neat was how other agencies came in and staffed our engine houses for us. Shelby County came in, put a ladder truck, a pumper, and another engine house. That something that was real neat was that when we found out later that Memphis was a little later coming in with their PD, and a lot of them ended up being traffic cars. When asked what they could do, they went and blocked off every intersection, every driveway, every business where ambulances could pull out onto Bahia Road and never stop until they hit the interstate. Talking to some of the unit crews, when they pulled out, they were able to just go and never slow down all the way to the hospital. That was pretty much, you know, people going, well, what can I do? And we'll go do this. And they'll stop it. Memphis had our intersections blocked off. It was, you know, basically an escort right there to the hospitals. Command staff from Memphis and Shelby County already had Germantown, but I had depleted Germantown. I had used everything Germantown had. I don't know how they were pretty much functioning. Thank goodness we didn't have a lot of calls. But I do know that the command staff, Memphis and the county, walked up to me and said, what do you need? It looks like it's over. We're going to start. And I said, I really wish y'all wouldn't, because I think I don't have anything in this end of the county. And they said, you know what? We're going to put three units over here. You need anything, you need to call Rand, we got you. You just tell us what we got so we can run it through our dispatch and document the call. But anything y'all need, we got it. Shelby County put their engines there. The help that we received, even after we were closing up the incident, because we were stretched thin throughout this end of the county, I'd say the south end of it. And just to see all those chief officers sitting there going, we got y'all. We'll help you. What do you need? How can we do it? I'll put you a ladder truck in your station. I'll leave you three units right here if something comes in. What else could you ask for?
What are your thoughts?
I agree with both of them. And the ability to organize this. I mean, if you sit back and think what we faced, I do feel like it was organized. It's almost how I've described it in the past, is it was organized chaos, but it was because of training. I mean, we had 22 ambulances, two helicopters from seven different agencies, and two agencies that provided additional fire equipment. So a big nod to our mutual aid departments and surrounding departments. Obviously couldn't have done it without them, but the ability to organize and get resources there, I think, were the two things that we did right for sure.
Hindsight's so easy, but now you think about it, what are the lessons learned?
Well, I think I would train differently for it. and look at it a little differently. The way we always kind of practiced it wasn't as realistic as it was, but it's never really going to be that way, right? Because getting planted. But I think a lesson learned is I personally think the incident command system can work on anything, and it worked that day. And I believe that if you train and you use that within, you know, a unified system like we did that day with the police, with other departments, I think we were all able to come in and operate pretty much the same way. I didn't have to explain to anybody how I wanted them to do it. I just said, I want this done. And they went in and implemented that. You know, other lessons would be probably work on maybe a mutual aid channel or something like that. Maybe plan out your, you know, that large scale incident a little better, maybe where we could have talked to everybody.
Most departments, police, fire, everyone share.
Right. And I think that kind of hindered us that day, that a lot of times you'd grab your radio and weren't able to talk. But we did it so well face to face once we got that. And it wasn't just but a second that we weren't all together. We were lucky. I think it was mentioned earlier that we have worked so many incidents together. We had had so much practice. We knew the faces that were showing up. And I think that's a big part of how that worked with all the agencies coming in. But we did know each other, you know, and I think that's a big, you need to have that relationship before something like that happens. I think it's really, really important.
Lessons learned.
I would say that make sure everybody at every level in your organization that could function in a role completely understands that role. We got lucky that day because it did work in the after action reviews with some of our folks that we talked about. Hey, what if we had assigned you this position? That's not the time that you want them to wonder, do they understand everything that entails that? As I have mentioned, as Chief mentioned, you know, incident command system works, but it's only going to work if everybody there can apply it to their role. So I think that's one thing. That would give them some flexibility to be able to do different things, such as working in divisions and that. That's a big one for me.
For me, it was communication issues. Although, like Chief Grizzard said, it worked. But we made it work. Face-to-face ended up being the best way to communicate. But I learned that day that your radio systems can become overtaxed quickly. Have that ability. Have those conversations on what to do if. And working with the police department, one of the things that we talked about, too, was our difference in terminology, ensuring that we talk the same. So we, as the fire service may say, the alpha side, or police department may call it the 1, 2, 3, or 4 side. So iron those things out on the front end and train together. And then keeping situational knowledge. Like we spoke about the multiple times that we were told there was another shooter or possibly an explosive device in a car. I just felt that I needed to do better at keeping that situational awareness.
Do appreciate it. Battalion Chief Mike Sansone and Lieutenant Jim Boats Hunsucker and Germantown Chief Eric Gazar. Thank you so much for the time, insights, conversation.
You're listening to Emergency FD Storyline, Active Shooter on the Fireline. I'm Tom Mann, and I want to take a moment to remind you to follow and subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to Emergency FD Storyline, and be sure to share it with others. The more listens and downloads we receive makes a big difference for us. And look for us on Facebook and Twitter and follow us. And please feel free to share the podcast with others. Let folks know about Emergency FD Storyline. Our Emergency FD Storyline is titled Active Shooter, The Fireline. This podcast would not have been possible without the help of Collierville Chief John Selberg. At the time of this incident, Chief Selberg was the fire chief of the neighboring Germantown Fire Department. After retiring from his many years with Germantown, he picked up the mantle as chief of the Collierville Fire Department. In his new role as chief, he wanted to tell this story and to tell what worked and what they did to save lives. Can you tell me a little bit of the overview of what happened? Because again, at the time, you were the Germantown fire chief, neighboring community. Now you're the Collierville fire chief.
What was interesting that day, we had a joint team that was working on a vaccination site here in Germantown. And it was the Collierville and Germantown officials, particularly the fire and police departments, that were coordinating this vaccination site. So we were actually doing a virtual meeting, planning our next operations, and I was the person in charge of that team. So I'm actually running a team meeting. I'm starting to call on the police and fire department to report out their sections. and they're all gone. And I'm
this is the height of COVID too. We got to mention that.
Yes, it was during COVID, so we had a really nice vaccination site going. Did a very nice job. All my officials are gone. They've left my meeting. They were just there, and I'm trying to figure out what. Well, I got a text that there was an active shooter at Collierville at the Kroger. So I said we have to wrap up this meeting. Some of my staff had already responded out there, so I responded out there. What was interesting, also the Germantown Police Department was also responding. They actually had a shift change about to happen, so they sent one shift out there to cover the community of Collierville and one that covered Germantown, so it allowed Collierville to focus on the incident. Went out there, actually saw that they had a pretty good setup out there handling the incident in Collierville, and offered assistance that we had, sent some ambulances that early on that transported some, what I would say, some very critical patients. I was quite impressed with how quickly we were treating the patients. You know, in our business, we really want to get them treated well, but quickly. These patients were going to require hospital care. They weren't just going to be able to be treated in the back of the ambulance. I was impressed with how they did that. I offered any assistance I could to the command, and they had, a good handle on what was going on, and I was quite impressed with that operation.
So tell me a little bit about the story of what took place that day, more of it.
It's like any incident we go to like this, you're gathering information. The law enforcement were doing the same thing. You had reports of an active shooter. There was a report of multiple active shooters, so you didn't know what you had. There was a report of a shooter in the Kroger, then another report of one on the roof. Multiple shooters. We were getting all these different reports that it was moving scene, that it was not staying there at the Kroger. So you had all these reports. You knew you had a lot of responding assets coming in, but we really didn't know as far as how many victims, how critical the victims were going to be yet. So, you know, on that situation, you know, you go big. You send as much as you can. And Collierville was asking for everything they could get. That's what you've got to do to make sure you have enough resources. And we are fortunate. You know, we're right on the suburb of a large community. So a lot of us had a lot of assets that we could provide to it. Fire apparatus, most of ours are also what we call ALS fire engines. So all the personnel are paramedics and EMTs. Several of us have our own ambulance services, so we were able to provide that very quickly. That's probably one of the nicest things is that mutual aid relationship we all have in this area that we can send in quickly and help.
The story was what? An employee or a contracted employee had an issue with something at work. What happened?
We learned later it was a sole employee of a contract company that was providing, I believe it was sushi. He was a sushi chef at the Kroger there, and had some issues that morning, and actually had been terminated. The manager, I think, had a meeting with him prior to his departure, and I think he was upset about that, and some employees had also supported the accusations. So he was, I guess, angry. I'd gone home, and then we understand he came back later that afternoon with some weapons, basically just came in and started opening up, shooting at people in the store. You had some that were wounded up front. Then he followed some out the back door, back towards the dumpsters, shot several of them that were trying to hide back in the dumpster enclosure in the back, and then went back inside. They were still trying to figure out where he was at, and then he ended up terminating his own life inside the store at that point.
Again, when you think about what took place, how do you see this incident as a chief? Now you're part of both the communities that really had a big impact on this, handled this, and so why share it?
Many of us have been through a lot of training on active shooter. We've seen it progress over the years, which I think it's gotten much better in how we operate. But you often see that we basically wait till the scene is totally secure before we're able to go in. And in our job, you know, we know there's risk involved. And sometimes we're willing to take a lot of risk for a large gain, particularly to save a life. But you never know what you're going to really do until you are actually thrown into those situations. And I was so proud of how they handled this, particularly the Collierville firefighters getting on the scene, having the ballistic gear to go in and be safer going in there. The town had done a really nice job providing that for them, but they realized that to save lives, they were going to have to take and place themselves at risk and go inside. And they did that because they were concerned for those people inside. And they took that risk to save lives. And when you look back at it, my understanding is that's the first time you've actually had EMS enter in with law enforcement while you still had an active shooter scene going. Because did not know where the shooter was, if he was had been neutralized yet. So they were going in with the understanding that he could be right there with them. It was a very nice operation between the police and fire. And that's one of the things I think is important, that as we train on this, if you train just as a fire department, you've got to do it with the police department, because they have to feel comfortable engaging you in that operation, or else they're going to want to keep you back. And fortunately, we had that relationship here where the law enforcement took the fire and EMS with them inside to start that treatment, and they protected the firefighters as they did that. So I think that's kind of the what we all envision, but you're not always sure it's going to happen, and that's probably what makes me the proudest of what happened that day.
They may criticize it and say, you should have triaged better, you should have coordinated this better, you should have coordinated that better. I use this term fog of war. There's a lot of shoulda, coulda, woulda, but there's a lot of things. Things were done right in this incident.
Let me back up. When I first came to Collierville, right after we had our first large structure fire, we were doing a critique of it, and they were talking about some of it, and I think they were a little unsure what the new chief was going to say, and they finally came around to him, and I said, guys, I've been fighting fire for over 40 years, and I still haven't had the perfect fire. On an emergency, you're going to have things not go perfect. But if you meet the objectives, and the objective was saving lives, and you do everything you can to make that happen, that shows you care and that you have trained and worked to put yourself in a position to save those lives. And that's what they did. I mean, you can second guess it. I critique a lot of incidents, and I'm like, we could have done that better. We could have done that better. Sure. But what happened was the people's lives were saved. And that's really what it comes down to. If you look at what these men and women did on that scene, it's amazing. And I'm so proud of what they did, both not just Collierville, but even the mutual aid responding agencies that came in and helped them.
The injuries of some of the folks that were sent to these hospitals quickly, I guess some of the EMS personnel thought they weren't going to make it. And they did.
After we found out that we only had one fatality, I talked with some of the transporting paramedics, and I told them we only had one fatality. And both of the medics said, that was mine. And I'm like, no, both of yours survived. They said they had horrible injuries. And they said, I can't believe that they survived. And I said, yes, they survived. Y'all did that great of a job. And the hospital did that great of a job, kept them alive. And that's what it's all about, is saving those lives.
Ballistics. This is just kind of off the ballistics in the fire. wearing ballistic gear in the fire service. I don't think I ever thought about that until just recently. Are you not a believer in that?
I am now. that's one of the last things I did at Germantown, was put it in my budget to get it for them. And they have it now at Germantown. But when I saw how much more comfortable I would be as a chief seeing my personnel going into a crime scene, knowing that they had that level of protection, that's a big deal. You know, I said I've been around a little while. I never would have imagined that. But it can make you feel much more comfortable knowing those people know they're protected.
It says rescue,
yes, sir,
on the gear. I want to be sure that said that, right? The good,
yes,
guys,
sir.
Is that?
And at Germantown, I think they even got them the same colors, their turnouts. So one other thing that was kind of special with this situation, and I think we've gotten better at it, but community relations. Collierville did a really nice job with their community relations, and I was really impressed with that. Very early on, while the scene was now not active, as soon as they could get the information out to the community, because there was a lot of misinformation. We had, you know, second shooter, there was shooting going down the road, there was all these different stories. They very quickly set up press briefings, and the town PIO did a nice job of bringing the police chief and the fire chief and town officials together to actually tell what they knew and get the message out as soon as possible. And I think that kept from having a lot of additional rumors going on. And then they kept coming out with additional briefings and kind of bringing the community together. And I think that's why everyone handled it so much better, because they felt like we're getting true information, what's going on, and we can appreciate what really happened here. So they did a really nice job with that, and they're still, you know, telling the story. And that's one of the things I wanted to do when I became the chief. I just didn't feel like they had told their story enough, that people really understood we can do this. We've been talking about this for years. We can actually save these lives if we just get in there quick enough, have that coordination with the police department, and jointly work together with them. It can be done.
Collierville Chief John Selberg. Before we conclude our podcast, I want to take a moment and talk with retired Memphis firefighter George Langston. In March of 2000, George Langston lived through an active shooter incident. He was literally a survivor in so many ways. And George has been in the room listening to the conversations you just heard. I've asked George to share his thoughts and insights as he looks down through the years. And once again, I want to remind you, you can hear his full two-part interview called Surviving the Unthinkable by going to our website, emergencyfd.com or emergencyfdstoryline.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. So, George, when you hear the story that you just heard, what goes through your head?
It certainly brings back a lot of the things that the incident that I was involved in, there were some parallels. It was kind of surreal how much of it was the same type thing. I mean, that's a lot of time. And to come back and hear these guys and how it was handled, it was great. Sounded great. Just to have the presence of mind and then talk the chief talking about they had just done that training. At the time, even though it was just 2000, we really hadn't had that training because the world was turning, but it hadn't turned that quick, you know, at that time for us. We had some units, you know, shot at, but we were never really the main focus of the attack.
I guess that was a big difference because all of a sudden, you know, I think I mentioned to you, I never heard that term active shooter back in the day when that happened. And I remember going to that incident. I remember the aftermath of it.
Yeah.
And seeing you walking around.
Yeah.
You told me that you were just like laser focused when you were sitting in there in that cab. You're sitting there, the driver, you lieutenant's getting shot out here by you. Your assistant driver just got shot. Your other firefighter, nozzleman, says, hey, we're being shot at. But you just kept doing what you were doing.
Well, yeah, at that point, you know, I turned around and said, hey, guys, you know, we're not playing. Because that never crossed my mind until he said that. It was toward the end of the incident that I knew that the assistant driver was shot. Had no idea.
But you kept doing your job.
Yeah, Memphis has lots of personnel. So we had three pumpers, a truck, you know, in within a few minutes. In Hickory Hill, where this took place at, we had plenty of equipment. So we had like 16 guys there in a matter of 4 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever it was, you know. Nobody really knew what to do at that time. I had 10 years on, a little less than 10 years. So I could see of the time that has passed, how training has really helped. I retired in 2018, and a year, 2 years before that, we had started the active shooting training and doing the same thing that they put in motion there, where they would go in and treat the people immediately, and the police would clear an area, support them, and go on to the next person.
You know, I can hear it in their voices and when they talk, and they talk about the incident and the things that go through your heads. Tell me about that, because your healing process was a long time.
Oh, yeah.
You were the guy that survived what took place.
Right, right.
You hear that process. I still hear that same process where it's a traumatic event, even though you may be working an incident.
I think hearing them, getting their guys together then was a great thing to do. Our debriefing or whatever, it happened a little bit later, and then I had one of the people call, hey, you all right? Yeah, I'm all right, because I was in that stupid era that, you know, you fall, you get back up, you know, it's okay, but it's not.
How traumatic is that? You've talked a lot to a lot of people about that. You share that incident. And now it's a lessons learned, but one thing you talk about is a pretty powerful story.
The main thing, there's very few firemen that don't have a fireman story. But, of course, that one was a big incident, and it was certainly bad. But a lot of the aftermath of it is just as important as what wasn't done there. And the fact that taking care of your people and your people being of the right mindset to take care of themselves, you can't replace that. And what they did in those hours afterwards, or it could be 2 hours, I'm not sure of their time. Any first responder who's been up against that wall, they need to talk to somebody that knows what they've been through. You can't go home and tell your wife, your mother, father. You can't discuss it with your best buddy. First responders have a first responder life, and then they have their regular life. So if something happens in your first responder, you need to talk to first responder people, whoever your group is. That's the only way that you're going to get help. Are you going to go and you're going to do something detrimental to yourself or something else? You know, unfortunately, along with all the other things, abuses of drugs and alcohol, suicide has stepped up. Even when we were doing my incident, you know, it wasn't too long before that somebody had committed suicide that worked on the fire department, taking their life, you know, for whatever reason.
Talk about wearing ballistic gear. Back in the day, like I said, you were the good guys.
Yeah.
But it does show you how things have changed, even the mindset a little bit.
Yeah. There's basically, I don't know what it is, but, you know, because you're there to help them means nothing to that caliber of person. Everybody there you're trying to help loves you, as they should. But to that caliber of person, it means nothing. They've got their mind set. They just want to hurt somebody, kill somebody. That's all they got on their mind. The one thing that I want to pass along, and anytime I talk to any of the new recruit classes or anything, is that I beg them to get help. It doesn't have to be anything as dramatic as what I went through or these guys, but in society today, it's certainly gotten a lot tougher and a lot more violent. I mean, how many times can you go and continue to see somebody with a bullet in their head or this, you know, are tangled up in this? You need to get your mental health as much as they concentrate on their physical health. You know, you can be the strongest man in the world and have the big muscles, but if your mind's mush, you're not going to be able to do this job. It's going to tear you apart. It's going to tear your family apart. So you have to keep your mental state of mind in it to be in this game. If you want to play the game, if you want to be a part of the first responder unit, you've got to keep your mental health. And I think a lot of the seasoned firefighters, that's probably your most pushback, because the younger firefighters have always been told, you know, that's part of the thing from the last few years, where your older ones, not so much. That's where you get most of your pushback. I enjoy the fire department and what we did. I'm very proud of what first responders do. I enjoyed coming out. And I appreciate you giving me the invitation and listening to these guys and everything like that, because every one of those people should thank them, because it could have been a lot worse for them.
Active Shooter, The Fire Line. That's our storyline. If you would like to contact Emergency FD Storyline with comments or to suggest a story or a subject for an upcoming podcast, you can email us at storyline@emergencyfd.com. That's storyline@emergencyfd.com. Also, check our website at emergencyfd.com or emergencyfdstoryline.com. You can find us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, and look for Emergency FD or Emergency FD Storyline. I'm Tom Mann, and I want to thank you for listening. There are many stories coming on Emergency FD Storyline. Join us.